change your script. Think about what you would normally, ordinarily say in certain situations and change it. And suddenly by changing that script that is expected, you're opening the door to such a wonderful conversation.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age, from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Curious Advantage podcast. My name is Garrick Jones, and I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage. And today we're delighted to be joined by Stefan von Hooydonk. Hi, Stefan.
Hi, Garrick.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, Stefan. You've been the founder of the Global Curiosity Institute. You're a best-selling author, and you've lived and worked in 9 countries, I believe, including serving as chief learning officer at Cognizant. And can you share a little bit about how you got here and why you're here today and why curiosity became such a driving force along the way, alongside us? I mean, I think we were on similar journeys at similar times.
Isn't it lovely indeed? Yes, actually, you guys wrote a book a year before your book came out, about a year before my book came out. And the Curiosity Institute is now about 5 years old. We have the biggest database in the world on curiosity. We've got now over 12,000 people and 200 companies that have been analyzed in curiosity. And the insights are still coming every day. It's amazing because I was working with an MIT professor recently, and he said, like, curiosity is something like innovation 50 years ago. It's still such a moving target, and everybody's looking at it from their perspective, but it hasn't really found its core yet. And that's why we need more people like yourself and the Institute and more researchers to come up with a definition. How do I get here? I realize now I was never a really curious person. We try to tell ourselves that we're always curious, but actually we aren't. I found out in the meantime. But I got in tune with curiosity when I was chief learning officer at Cognizant, really. We changed the culture dramatically from buying resources to building resources, because Cognizant is an IT company, and there were not enough people that were capable of IoT, Internet of Things, or machine learning, or digital engineering. So we had to train people inside. We had to build people from inside. So we needed a completely new culture around development, around growth, around allowing people to stick out their neck and be more certified, etc. We realized suddenly that not everybody was jumping on this wagon. We were giving all the opportunities to people, but only less than 20% of the population, and at a big company, you know, 300,000 people, I was chief learning officer, only about 20% of the people were really keen on joining this new path. Although it came with more money, it came with more responsibility, it came with more sexy project, etc. And we started wondering, why is this? And can we tweak it? And suddenly we bumped into the notion of curiosity. And we didn't realize the concept really well. Is curiosity something you're born with? Is something you can develop? And we just tried, because we were a heavy kind of piloting organization. And we tried doing these short webinars with people, teaching them about neuroplasticity, teaching them about different concepts of curiosity, giving them ideas about strategies and how to be more curious. And 3 months later, when we checked in with those people, we realized and asked, did you start looking at the world slightly differently? Did the specs that we give you enable you to view the world differently? And actually, the majority of people said yes. And that was a really kind of a hopeful data point. But the magic started 12 months later when we started looking at the learning behavior of all the 15,000 people we had piloted, so it's a sizable group, and compared them to the rest of the organization. And we realized, and we saw through data, that those people we had trained had on average 43 hours of learning under their belt for the 12-month period, while the rest of the organization only had 25 hours of learning. So it's almost double. And what we learned from this, and actually I left my job on that realization to set up the institute, is that first of all, we need permission. And an organization needs to give permission for people to stick out their neck for curiosity. And it doesn't come naturally, but permission is really important. And then another awareness that came to us is permission is just the first step. It's great, like companies that have curiosity in their corporate values and kind of where the C-suite is kind of promoting curiosity to the team, but you also need to give people tools. You need to give people tools and practices to really put it into practice. And those two together are creating the entire dynamic. And as I said, I left the company realizing that there was so little research done in this space. I needed to do something about it. And you guys came up with your book and I wrote down the book and I started doing diagnostics on the individual level, on the team level, the organizational level. And here we are again.
Here we are again. You know, there's so many things you talk about which fascinate me and which I want to explore more. I mean, from neuroplasticity to strategies to be more curiosity, but and also the data points that you've been picking up in your research. I really want to explore those a little more. But the first thing, when you talk about we need to get permission from our organizations to be curious, that's fascinating. But then you link it up with tools. And my question is, what are some of the tools that you were giving people?
Well, there's tools at different levels. The model that I'm using often is permission, awareness, intentionality.
Mm-hmm.
And you can apply it at the individual level, but also at the team and the organizational level. So first of all, this permission. Am I giving myself permission to lean into my curiosity when I'm in a team? Do I allow myself to ask the question or do I stay silent? When there's something fearful, when I have a choice between going to, for instance, stupid example, a new restaurant or a restaurant that I know already, which one should I choose? Do I give myself permission to explore this unknown? Once you have that, once you give yourself permission, you're entering the stage of awareness and you allow yourself to slow down and observe yourself or your organization, your friends, your environment. Are they uplifting me? Are they bringing me down? In which situation do I find myself more curious versus not? Am I more curious about the world or am I more curious in my social relationship? Am I also curious about myself type of thing, you know? And once you slow down and you observe, you get some insights and then you're invited to take action. And that's what I call intentionality. Because there's all kind of doors that present themselves. Am I then opening those doors or do I leave them shut? Because sometimes you might say I'm fine or it's too much for me. You can't be curious about everything, you know? Curiosity needs also some stability. If you change your job, if you change your house, if you change your relationship all at once, is almost like a recipe for depression rather than you need some stability in your life and some grounding and some before you to show up curiously. So if you're talking about strategies, maybe we could talk about more and more strategies in a second. But for me, the model about permission and awareness and intentionality applies in many areas.
Yeah, yeah.
And if everybody can realize what that means for him or herself in that regard.
These are the first steps to getting through the door. You might approach the door, you're curious, you want to know what's on the other side. But you have to, as you say, give yourself permission and then that achieves even more awareness of where you need to go. And then the intentionality is to go through the door and to be brave. And you, within that safe space, you need to have that safe space in order to be curious, whatever level you're talking about. I mean, it's fascinating, really useful tool that I think. I wanted to ask you about the data. What's some of the big learning points that you're picking up from the data points in the research?
Well, there's many data points. For instance, there's one data point that young professionals show up with less curiosity than people that have been 5 to 10 years in the job. And that's counterintuitive because often when we're in the beginning of things, beginning of a relationship, beginning of a job, we tend to be more curious. But my hypothesis is that once you leave university and get into the workspace, it's a completely new ballgame. And it takes a while for you to get bearings in order to kind of to be really at ease with accepting the new environment. Another data point, I started launching a maturity model since the beginning of this year. We were trying to check through culture and practice. And the lowest score that we're getting is the physical environment.
Interesting.
At work, the environment is not really supporting me to be curious. And I just finished an article on art in the boardroom and what modern art does to our mental capacity and our decision-making and our openness to others when we have or when we don't have modern art in the environment. So the environment has a huge impact on how we show up. And often facility managers and people don't think about this. When we're staying in the boardroom, often we assume that the mere intellectual power of the individuals and the experience of the individuals is enough to create good decision-making.
Mm.
But actually, the environment has a huge impact. The team dynamics has a huge impact on the good or not so good decisions that come out. So workplace is a really important data point that came out now. The second lowest dimension is HR, talent practices.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an area for many organizations to work on, I think. Do we want to really encourage curiosity? Another data point is that after 3 years in the same role, people's curiosity goes down. The same in relationships. After 3 years in this, because a relationship is also a role.
We've split up after seven years, didn't it?
Yes, but now probably, I don't know what happened, but it's my data points talk more about 3 years. And that after 3 years, it's not that we're losing our curiosity, but it means that we have to try harder.
Mm.
And that's a challenge, right? It's a positive challenge. And when we do this, when we engage more with customers of 3 years, with colleagues of 3 years, with partners of 3 years, there's magic to be gained there. But so that's a data point. Middle managers are about four times less ready to say that curiosity is a good thing for an organization.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
Well, I compare four times to both their seniors and the people reporting to them. I think it's often curiosity at the mid-management is a lonely practice if it goes wrong. Because everything around middle management is all about the desire for efficiency. They get marching orders from above and are supposed to manage as an efficient operation as possible. And changing the plane en route is a difficult thing, especially when the potential of going wrong is there. Because when things go wrong, it's a very lonely proposition because it affects your career, it affects your bonus, it affects many things, also your upward mobility. And with that, when I'm asking people whether curiosity is a positive thing for an organization, links to innovation, whatever, 90% say yes.
Hmm.
When I ask a follow-up question, are you inviting curiosity into your own team? Only 50% say yes. So curiosity is a practice and a theory. In theory, we think it's good. In practice, I'd rather have somebody else deal with it because I'm focused on efficiency and I don't have time for this. I don't give myself permission for this.
Stefan, you've said curiosity is learned through language, and we agree with that completely. But how does that shape how we experience and express curiosity in our lives and work?
Well, curiosity and language is an important one at many levels. We think in language, and we have this love-hate relationship with curiosity in society, in families, in environments. For instance, countries with heavy religious control or heavy political control, they don't want people to be as curious. And how that gets translated is through language. And I'm often suggesting people think about your childhood. What language did your parent use around curiosity? Was it something good or was it something to stay away from? And how did it kind of manifest itself, not only in language, but also in action, in simple things? Did you go on holidays to all the time or the same place? Or did you go to different places? Or maybe back to the restaurant example, did you always go to the same restaurant? Or did you choose new restaurants all the time? Were you exploring new cuisines? And it's very intuitive that when your parents are creating an environment which is open-minded, exploration-based, etc., then you're more likely to follow that path as a child. The same in organizations. Actually, I just did a post on this about curiosity being social.
Mm.
If a manager uses language that is very exploration-minded, if the manager is saying, oh, I've just read this article in Harvard Business Review, or I explored this, or I spoke to that person and I got a new insight, and I've proven it with data, the team also follows suit and the team will also have a learning mindset.
Mm.
If the manager does not have this mindset and related language, the team will fall flat on learning because they know it's not required behavior. my manager's probably valuing something else. And the same is happening for salespeople. The same is happening for different teams. And then you find in many societies, like curiosity killed the cat, that's language, and all Curious George, always getting into trouble. So basically, we're telling kids in Curious George that curiosity is actually exploration is leading to something wrong. And Curious George always needs this adult figure, this boss, to get him out of trouble. And that's language that uses curiosity in promoting or telling people that curiosity is something that comes with a slight edge, that comes with a slight negative connotation. Or back to the religious dimension, in Polish, there's a saying apparently, I don't speak Polish, people told me that curiosity is the first step to hell. That's what they say. and that probably likely has to do with a very heavy religious impact that the church, way back in time, didn't want the people to stick out their net and explore and do things. Look at St. Augustine, you know, he said that curiosity is getting us away from our focus on God.
It's fascinating. You talk about the legacy of these structures from our parents and the language they use, or our home life and how we've been brought up, and our countries and the culture of our countries and the legacy of those cultures all have an impact on our view and our openness to be curious. And yet we think curiosity is so important in this digital age, being able to look further and broader and having sets of tools that enable us to not accept what we first find or just follow things as they're given to us, but really to question things. You know, you talked about these business structures and how they draw from the models of the church and the military, but how do these old paradigms still shape our organizations is one thing, but then we know that they're limiting, and they're limiting curiosity, sometimes for control purposes, as you've said. But what's the alternative? And what is the reward, do you think? Because if we need a new shape for a new age, what do you think that is? And then why? You know, what is the reward that we get by being open and being more curious for in our countries and our homes and our organizations?
Whoa, this is a philosophy session. Beautiful. Now, I think church and religion have had a huge impact on how we started structuring companies. Mm. In the Industrial Revolution, the only model that we had, or the people then had, about big organizations was indeed those two systems. And quite interesting, and Frederick Taylor picked up on it later on, but probably I'll pick out one dimension, is the role of harmony. Mm. Harmony in religious environments, also in the army, are hugely important. And harmony means not rocking the boat, not challenging the status quo. Innovation goes against harmony. Mm. In many organizations, even customers are disruptive against the harmony. I find it amazing whether CEO, when we see online that the CEO is spending 30%, 40%, 50% of his time with customers, as if it's an anomaly. Because indeed, most people are spending their energy internally, kind of structuring and managing and organizing. In my language, curiosity, the opposite is conformity.
Yeah.
And conformity and harmony go probably hand in hand, because harmony is keeping the same and not rocking the boat, and conformity is staying with the past. And it's about keeping, while curiosity is about seeking. And that's already kind of a dimension that is preventing many organizations deep down, unconsciously at the organizational level, from wanting to go the extra mile.
This is fascinating for me because I understand completely the relationship between harmony and conformity, but it also plays into people's need for structure and safety. And you can see in turbulent times, I mean, it can go extreme, may even end up in people seeking solace in fascism, if you like, something which is structured, or even totalitarianism, because the world seems too complex and the world seems too out of control. We have these tendencies in our, you know, society. We saw it before the Second World War in Weimar. We're seeing it, there are elements of it today, where the amount of chaos and that is about leads people to choose more safe structures, sometimes beyond just the church, right? And then the question is, if there's something to be gained from being seekers and seeking and having that kind of relationship with information and the world, What does that mean for all the chaos? How do I cope with the chaos, and how do I cope with that need for safety that might drive me to become a keeper rather than a seeker?
I had probably two thoughts. First of all, let's go back to the notion of permission, awareness, and intentionality. And that already kind of helps somehow. Am I giving permission to curiosity, or am I giving permission to disharmony or conformity? And then what follows at the awareness and intentionality level? That's probably one dimension. And another dimension, probably three dimensions, that we said earlier, that curiosity needs stability. Stress is one of the great barriers to curiosity. And the more stress we experience around ourselves, all kind of stress, can be personal stress, can be societal stress, can be social media stress, can be many other things. The more we have stress, the less we're ready to explore the new. Because as you said, the world is too complex, and we have a desire to make the world more simple. And then probably the third dimension is, of those two, conformity and curiosity, conformity is the stronger one. Because there's almost this gravitational pull towards conformity. In the beginning, we're curious. But after a while, we settle for this new reality. We stop asking questions. We sometimes don't even dare to ask questions, because we create this new reality we feel comfortable with. When we're setting up a company or we're setting up a department, it's difficult for the first generation to change, because they've created the past type of a thing. So this conformity is the stronger one. And that's why curiosity, for me, needs its intentionality. Because without intentionality, we're always, it's kind of like an elastic band that pulls us towards this conformity, because the more we let it do its job, the more it feels comfortable. It's an illusion of comfortable. And the more we need this intentionality to pull us the other way. That's why curiosity is hard. That's why it requires energy. A little bit of pulling in the other direction gets us into learning new stuff, exploring new worlds, getting better with our relationship, exploring ourselves. If we pull even harder to the direction of curiosity, we explore completely new terrains.
Yeah.
Which is even harder. But of course, the rewards are bigger.
The rewards are bigger. It may not be safe, or may not feel safe, or as you say, it's an illusion. I really love that. But the rewards are actually better, because it's a more difficult path. And it requires intentionality, as you say, and bravery and courage. But the rewards are better. We're talking to Stefan van Hooydonk. He's the founder of the Global Curiosity Institute and author of the best-selling book, The Workplace Curiosity Manifesto, and the newly released book, Curiosity, the Secret Ingredient for Success in Personal and Professional Growth. After working initially in investment consulting and setting up executive education at the China European International Business School in China, Stefan held executive roles as chief learning officer in Fortune 200 companies like Nokia and Royal, Philips and Cognizant and Aramco, Agfa and Flipkart. He's lived and worked in Belgium, France, Hong Kong, China, Finland, the Netherlands, India, Saudi Arabia and the United Kingdom. And his last role was that of chief learning officer for Cognizant, where he oversaw L&D for over 300,000 associates across the globe. In your book, you distinguish between intellectual, empathic, and personal curiosities. Why is it important to separate these? And how can our organizations nurture each one, I guess? But what's the difference between intellectual, empathic, and personal curiosity?
I've differentiated between these to highlight that curiosity is a complex matter. We all have a surface level definition. If you ask anybody in the street, we have some definition of curiosity, but it's kind of a quick definition. We use language, but we don't think about language. That's the role of philosophers. That's the role of authors. You know, that's what I'm doing day in, day out, thinking deep next to my farming work, but we can talk about that later. So I try to create the difference between to make it meaningful and to highlight that this is a complex nature. For the typical definition that we have in society is curiosity about the world, kind of being curious about exploration, a child exploring a pebble on the street or on the beach, or an Einstein discovering the universe. And it's kind of intellectual curiosity that links to learning, that links to exploring new worlds. And that's really important, as it links at an organization level to creativity, to innovation and growth. But these are not the only dimensions. What I found that in our private lives, but also in our professional lives, we also have to deal with people. And it has a completely different dynamic, because people talk back.
stuff in the world does not talk back.
So curiosity about the people that I work with, the people that I live with, the people in my society, the people beyond my society, strangers, is also a really important thing and very different from curiosity. When we're talking about curiosity as linked to kids, like empathic curiosity only arrives at a later age, has nothing to do with curiosity about the world. And then the third dimension, and that's the hardest dimension, is curiosity of myself. Am I ready to explore my deeper beliefs, even my limiting beliefs, the thing that keep me to where I am or that propel me towards future great things? That's probably an insight that often people get from the book or from my speeches, is that curiosity can also go inward. We have two eyes to look at the world and to look at others, but it's harder for us to go inside. Apart from the stories that we tell ourselves, that I'm a nice guy and I know a little bit about curiosity, and you know, and but if you ask my partner or if you ask my mother or my friends, they'll come up with a very different version of me. I'm now 50, I always get it wrong, 57, I think. And that means that I've got 57 years of dust on my soul that prevent me from going inward. While the better I am at understanding myself, through meditation, through slowing down, through observing my deeper thing, to observing my breath, for instance, the more I can be strong in my curiosity of others, my curiosity of the world, including my dealing with things like new trends, like AI, because curiosity of the self gives me roots, gives me wings at the same time, because that's a function of resilience. That's a function of happiness.
There are so many directions we can go. Let's start with AI. That's disrupting everything. We can see it happening live in the economies and geopolitics right now. How does that relate to our curiosity and our need to be strong and our resilience that you talk about?
I'm still not entirely sure. If you're on social media, you either, for a long time, you had to be a techno-optimist, otherwise you were a old fart or somebody in the Middle Ages. And it's all about extremes that I find. What I'm trying to be somewhere in the middle and seeing whether AI is good, which we have to embrace it, but at the same time, not blindly. I've been doing some work around comparing AI to other new technology introductions. And I used, for instance, internet we can use, or maybe GPS. Mm. GPS has brought us many advantages, safety and efficiency. When there's a traffic jam, we take another route. But when you're actually going a bit deeper in what researchers have found is that we've lost a couple of skills. While introducing GPS, for instance, we've lost navigation skills. Mm. We find it weird to ask people for their directions. A couple of months ago, my smartphone was broken, so I printed out the directions to the place I had to go and speak. And two times on the road, I stopped my car and I asked the direction to a guy. And they laughed at me as if, well, nowadays nobody's asking for directions anymore. But probably the worst learning is learned helplessness.
Yeah.
Is that when our machine is breaking, when we don't have a GPS for the day, or when it doesn't work or the signal is not there, some people are not even making the travel anymore, not even going from A to B, because they're afraid that without their tool, they can't get there. So what I'm trying to say is whenever we're introducing something, it comes with many great benefits, but it will also come at a cost. Mm. And I don't think that we know enough about the cost, specifically maybe in the discussion around, shall we introduce AI into schools? When there's a lot of discussions going around whether we should introduce or whether we should roll back smartphones in schools, for instance.
Heard that too. We banned them in the UK. They're not allowing smartphones into the schools at all now.
You see, so why, if we've learned the hard way with just reading a book on the anxious generation about what social media has been doing for girls and with games have been doing for boys, and kind of rises in anxiety, rises in suicide rates, etc., because of the algorithms very much. It's not only correlation, it's even causation that is presenting in the book.
The jury's out. Proceed with caution.
I think so. Yeah. There was a recent research that the Financial Times brought out that in the last 12 or 13 years, literacy rate and mathematical kind of rate of our kids and their parents, adults, have been coming down. Mm. And my deeper question would be, can AI reverse that trend?
There's research showing that people are asking better questions because of the AI, so that there is a growing trend of people being able to specify in ways that they weren't before, because we are in turn trained by AI. Every time we ask a prompt and we go into it, we have to ask further questions, we get better at asking questions. So as you say, some things are gained and some things are lost, but what's beneficial to all of us, it remains to be seen. I really want to ask you about farming. I'm curious, because we're coming to the end of our conversation, which has been very wide-ranging, and I'm going to try and do a summary as best I can. But before, tell me about farming. You became a part-time farmer. You grow your own food. You became more self-sufficient. You eat what you produce. How has this changed you, or what got you there?
Well, we have a country house in the south of Belgium, and a couple of years ago, I saw this land for sale over Christmas. I called my wife because for a long time, I just wanted to have some lands to play with. And we discussed and we decided to buy it. And you have to understand, our daughter, she was really heavy on the sustainability track. She was one of those youngsters kind of, we were fighting for sustainability. And she was doing that at national levels and even at European levels. And she got completely burned out. She was talking to politicians and she was talking to industry who couldn't give, they didn't care really. It was all nice to have. And as a youngster, you just keep on fighting. And I probably took the baton from her and I said, okay, let me do it at my level. And let me try to, at a micro level, start a little farm, doing the right things and learning in the same time. And it turned out to be my curiosity project. I'm learning so much.
I have to ask, I mean, my curiosity project is music. Like, we can talk, you know, how having projects like this really teaches us and makes us go deep. But tell me about the farm.
I mean, it's when we talked earlier that curiosity goes down after the initial phases, it's not the case with hobbies and passions. Their curiosity always goes up. Mm-hmm. And it always has to do with completely intrinsic, and we're allowing ourselves to suck at it. And that's why we keep on. And in the meantime, we have 6 hectares, 60,000 square meters. I've got close to 300 trees. I just planted 3 weeks ago, 130 vines. I have a huge variety of, for instance, just on the apple side, we have almost 50 varieties of apples. I'm also a beekeeper in the meantime. Everything is organic and regenerative, and
wow,
created an hedge around the property of now close to 6,000 kind of bee loving bushes and shrubs and elderflower and all these type of flowery trees. And I often say that I spend about 80% of curiosity and then the other 80% I spend on the farm. And it feels that way because it helps me to combine nature and culture. And I'm learning so much from this project about myself, about nature, because that's a big curious project. I think sustainability and keeping, and I hope I'm a role model in the community, that we don't have to use land for creating feed for animals, but we can use the land to create food for immediately for humans. I also have a kind of a community garden on the land, where we're inviting families to grow vegetables together, to harvest them together. And it's kind of an equal, everybody who works gets an equal share in the product. So it's a very local.
Amazing.
It gives me energy as the curiosity work is.
It's amazing. I mean, you know, we learn from doing, and you are doing more than most. And it's inspiring. It really is. I mean, we've talked about so many things, like insights about curiosity, from neuroplasticity to strategies to be curiosity. We've talked about some of the learning that you've been done with your data points and how organizations have to give permission to be curious, and how permission is just the first step. The second is awareness, and that leads to intentionality. And that can happen at all levels, whether it's a personal level or the team level or at a social level. But we need these to connect with action in order to be curious. We've been learning about some of the data points that you've been accumulating in the Institute. Things like young professionals are less curious when they first start. Our middle managers are less likely to be curious or say that it's important because it's often a lonely practice at that level. But that also how important the physical environment is to curiosity, and why things like art in the boardroom is just a small step to having a huge impact. Talked about HR and talent practices, and how after 3 years in a single role, we might become less curious, and how we probably need to keep things shifting in order to stay awake and alive. We also had a fantastic philosophical conversation about curiosity and language, and how language is used and where it comes from, and how we were trained in language has an impact on our curiosity, and how the language that managers use has a huge impact on the teams. Also about how curiosity needs stability, and stress is a barrier to curiosity. But all of these things are only illusions, and how curiosity is about it, our intention to learn new things and to take things further and to get over our fears, and how we need to look at ourselves, because curiosity can be done at the level of the team and the society, but it is also, there's a place for us to examine our own selves and be curious there. And the role of structures and the question of harmony, and the question of, are you a keeper or are you a seeker? Are you just choosing safety and security for that sake, or are you finding a new security within seeking and allowing us to change and grow, because the rewards are better from seeking than they are from keeping? We also talked about intellectual, empathic, and personal curiosity, and we talked about farming and the need for being resilient, and how having a curious project allows us to learn about ourselves and the world around us, and allows us to become resilient in the face of so much change. The cost of not doing so, I think, is greater than the cost of staying alive and being curious. And these are the things you talked with me about today, and are hugely simulated and just fascinating. Stefan, if you have one thing to leave our listeners with, what would it be?
Well, one strategy that I find really useful is change your script. Think about what you would normally ordinarily say in certain situations and change it. For instance, if you like coffee and you go into your coffee shop and the person says hello or how you do or hiya or whatever, instead of just saying something nonsensical and something formulaic, say, for instance, oh, today, and you look at the name pick, you say, Garrick, today I'm a 7.2. What about you? And suddenly, by changing that script that is expected, you're inviting, or you're opening the door to such a wonderful conversation with that barista. But you can do the same with your kids. When your kids come home in the evening after school, don't say, how was school? Because they will always say something formulaic. They always say it's good, and they run off to their room. But ask them, what made you laugh today? Smile today? Or what was your highlight of history class? Or when your colleagues ask, come back on a Monday morning, don't ask how was the weekend, but ask something that changes really the script in that regard. Try it out. And that's just one of the strategies that I'm using, but maybe that could kind of shift the way we're looking at ourselves. Are we allowing ourselves to ask that question? And also, do we improve our relationship because of it?
Thank you, Stefan. Stefan van Hooijdonk, change your script. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understandings from neuroscience, anthropology, history, art, business, science, and behaviorism about curiosity, and makes these useful for everyone. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why this was so and what have you learned from it. We always appreciate hearing your listeners' thoughts and having a curious conversation. Join today at hashtag Curious Advantage. The book is available on Amazon and great bookshops near you, audio, physical, digital, or audiobook, to further explore the 7 C's model for being more curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Jessica Wickham.